Das ist Sehnenstark, der Podcast, der eintaucht in die Welt von Patella- und Achillessehnenschmerzen. Praxiserprobte Reha-Konzepte und die neuesten wissenschaftlichen Erkenntnisse erwarten dich hier. Also Ohren auf und reingehört.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of Sehnenstark. And as you might have noticed, this episode is going to be in English, since I have a guest who's German, sadly, isn't good enough for a German episode, I assume. So, my guest today is another tendon expert. There are not many, so I'm very happy to get you on, Byron. And you are a little bit wider in your in regard to the tendinopathies that you treat compared to me. And yeah, that's why you're here. So, although I only talk about patella and Achilles tendinopathies, I get asked quite a lot of questions about shoulder injuries, shoulder tendinopathies, although I never mention anything about that. But yeah, that's why I got you on. And so thank you very much, Dr. Byron Miller. Thank you for taking the time. And as we do in every podcast with a guest, I'd say you just introduce yourself for everyone that doesn't know who you are.
Sounds great. Thanks a lot for having me. I was really glad to be here. As you said, my name is Byron Miller. I'm a physical therapist based out in the U.S. I'm in the state of Utah, and I focus on tendons, like you said. My company is TendonRx, and I work with people with varied tendinopathies, as you said, like upper body, lower body, helping those people to get back to doing whatever it is they like to do. So I work with folks in a lot of different sports and help them to get back to what they're interested in. So really happy to be here talking to you today.
We want to talk about shoulder tendons today and see where the journey leads us. And usually one of the questions that I get is usually starting just to compare shoulder tendinopathies with patella and Achilles. And can you do the same that I post every day about for Achilles and patella tendinopathy? Can you do the same for all the shoulder injuries, for the shoulder tendinopathies? So going into that route, but starting with what kind of shoulder tendinopathies do you see, or upper body tendinopathies do you see most? Is it usually biceps? Is it just rotator cuff? Is it like tennis or golf elbows? Or what kind of tendinopathies do you see? Do you even differentiate?
Yeah, so I see kind of everything that you mentioned. I think that the technical term for rotator cuff tendinopathy, they're usually going to call that maybe rotator cuff related shoulder pain. And so it kind of encapsulates all of those things, maybe also including biceps. But yeah, we really work with any type of tendon issue in the shoulder. It can be tough to maybe be differentiating always exactly which muscle or tendon we're dealing with, unless we're, you know, we have an MRI or something like that. But yeah, absolutely see a lot of rotator cuff tendon and then biceps tendon as well. And then elbow golfers and tennis elbow. And then sometimes we'll see some more wrist type stuff. Actually, I was just working with a jiu-jitsu athlete. We were just speaking about jiu-jitsu, and she'd recently developed a tendon issue in her wrist. And so sometimes see that with like repetitive gripping stuff. But those are generally the upper body ones I'm working with. I have seen some other like less common ones, but those are the main ones I'm seeing usually.
I mean, you can get many tendinopathies that usually no one talks about. So, I mean, for the lower body, hip flexor tendinopathy is one thing that comes to my mind. But yeah, there are quite some tendinopathies that no one talks about. It's sometimes quite hard to identify which tendon is exactly the problem. And I mean, coming from the anatomical background, I know that especially in the shoulder, there are like all the tendons are so mixed together. They even like attach on the same bones and stuff. So, I mean, I come from a very practical standpoint. So, my question would be: do you even try to exactly differentiate between which tendon is exactly the painful one? Because I mean, it's kind of easy for me, and also hard in some cases, but patella and Achilles are very much on the outside. They're easy to detect, to palpate. And even then, it's sometimes not 100% clear. So how do you deal with that?
Yeah, so we know that the special tests that have previously been described to maybe be specific for specific rotator cuff muscles aren't that good. They are not that good in maybe being that specific. So I still use some of them, but I'm really looking to kind of maximally expose maybe some different structures, or really it's more I'm looking at different positions or different motions. If we are like, I'm really going to look to see maybe where are we having the pain? So is it more posterior shoulder or anterior shoulder, or maybe top of the shoulder, right? And then what motions really are bringing about the most pain? Because that is what is maybe more important to me. So there was an interesting study done by a guy named Chris Littlewood, and they were looking at kind of maybe using a single exercise. And what they were doing is looking at maybe which direction the shoulder moving was the most painful.
You have the MRI stuff, and you can like take pictures and see which ones are inflamed or changed in their structure. But do you even deal with that? Do you think that's useful, that it's even a thing to check? Or do you just go with whatever motion is painful, whatever position is painful? How do you approach that?
Yeah, great question. So for what you deal with, like Achilles and patellar, it's a little more straightforward. Sometimes there are obviously some other things we gotta rule out, but in the shoulder, it can be really tough to differentiate like which structure, maybe which tendon specifically is giving us an issue. And we know now that maybe the special tests that have been used in the past to try to differentiate which tendon it might be aren't really as accurate as we thought they were. So it may also not matter quite as much. So in my experience, usually what I'm going to try to do is maybe find where it's hurting, and then see if we can reproduce it. And often that's going to be in a specific shoulder motion. So there was a study by a guy named Chris Littlewood, and they were looking at how could we maybe use a single exercise to rehab rotator cuff tendinopathy versus maybe a ton of extra exercises. And they found that they were effective, actually. It's a really interesting study. Maybe we'll get into it. But the way in which they determined which exercise they were going to use initially was based off of which direction the person maybe had more pain in. So when we're talking about a shoulder, maybe we're going to talk about, you know, pushing out or abduction. So you could just have someone, you know, with a bent elbow pushing into the wall. And if they're getting more pain with that, it's most likely going to be a posterior cuff muscle. So supraspinatus, infraspinatus, something like that, right? But does it matter necessarily which one? I don't think so. I think it's maybe more important that we're communicating with the tissue through load, and we know that we're doing that in maybe the most effective position. So I'd usually be looking at that abduction or pushing out, external rotation, internal rotation, or shoulder flexion, so bringing the shoulder forward. That's what usually we're going to have more symptoms in, and usually that's going to drive what I'm going to do. So I do some of the special tests, but more often than not, I'm going to tell someone we're dealing with like a rotator cuff related shoulder pain with specifics of maybe you have more pain into internal rotation. And maybe that tells us, like, if it's internal rotation, maybe we're dealing with possibly a little bit more subscapularis. But that's usually how I'm going to say things. Like, maybe it's a little bit more this. That's kind of what I'm thinking. But more so, we're going to describe, like, what's the current function of the shoulder and how do these tests tell us about that?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, what I just thought about is Are the your clients or people that come to see you, are they interested in like knowing exactly what kind of muscle or what kind of tendon is hurting if they don't have an MRI?
It's interesting. I think it varies for the person. Honestly, some people don't care too much about the anatomy or anything. They're really just wanting to get better. Other people care almost as much as we do. They're very interested in specific anatomy. And so I feel like for the first person, I'm educating them a little bit more, you know, and then for that other person, I might honestly de-emphasize just a little bit anatomy, maybe it, especially if they've had concerning imaging. I might normalize partial tears. I might normalize the presence of tendinopathy on imaging. Because we know that there's a lot of folks walking around asymptomatic with those things and people that can rehab conservatively. So, and the people that are very, very anatomy focused, we're definitely going to acknowledge that, talk about that, but we might also talk about like, it's important that the shoulder is working as a whole. And then for those other folks that maybe haven't thought about the anatomy and it, if it's important, especially maybe sometimes, for specific positions, it can be helpful to let them know, oh, this is going to be like a more lengthened position for that tissue. And maybe that helps. Oh, yeah. Okay. I don't want to stretch that. So that's why I'm going to avoid that tissue. That might be some of the reasons I might get into the anatomy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I can imagine it's, as you said, it's individual and it's kind of some people are just super focused on the anatomy. And then it might be good to kind of zoom out a little bit and not getting too focused on that, because then people start Googling and what the exact function is, and then it might the symptoms might differ from the like the classical symptoms that you might find on different web pages, right? And then they're confused and then they come to you and talk about that, and so maybe that's a case where you just kind of want to zoom out, and in some other cases, just to explain to someone what the functions of a specific surgery is, helpful, right?
Yeah, yeah. I'll give an example. I just was working with a woman, and she is 9 months out from repair of supraspinatus, infraspinatus, and a bicep tenodesis. So pretty significant shoulder. She was in a car accident, pretty significant injury. And she has done a lot of the rehab. The shoulder has a good amount of function, but she still has quite a bit of pain. We're now 9 months out, and it is very clear she developed what's more like a tendinopathy presentation now, where it's all related to her loading, and it hurts a lot the next day. And so when I saw her, she'd already seen maybe two or three other physical therapists. And for her, I did find it important to bring in some of the anatomy, because it actually wasn't the structures that had been repaired that are really bothering her. There's some other things that are going on now from the offloading and then significant increase in activity. And so for her, it was important to know, like, hey, actually, the things that were repaired, you're not getting too much pain in those regions. That can help to reduce some of the threat. And then also, hey, actually, it's this other thing in these positions that you are regularly forcing your arm into are doing something to your substap potentially. And maybe we want to avoid some of that. And that was actually really helpful to link her current symptoms with what she was feeling, and no one had really done that for her in the past. So definitely when it matters, I think it's important to help it. I think if someone doesn't understand, it doesn't make sense to them, it's hard for them to buy in or to have hope. So whenever that's needed, definitely going to have that conversation.
Yeah, that's a great example of, I mean, people understandably so are, kind of scared that something might happen again, right? That it might tear again, that the surgery is not that successful, and it's very fragile. And just knowing that these structures are actually not the source of the pain, but rather other structures that might be just overworked now or overused because of some layoff, right? That's I think that's a nice example of that. Yeah, just going down the route of like patient communication. Is there? I mean, you know, that better than anybody in Achilles and patellar tendinopathy, we still have to fight the thought of or the belief of these tendons are inflamed, that it's an inflammation driven process and all that kind of stuff. And do you have the same discussion in the shoulder? Is it same stuff?
100%. I actually feel like I hear that inflammation, like I had the inflammation in my shoulder, maybe even more often than I hear in the lower body. Okay. I don't know if that's maybe because of the way it feels, like it's kind of this deep ache feeling, and for folks that's like correlated with inflammation. But absolutely, almost everyone is coming with the idea that inflammation is driving what they're dealing with. And the way that, so you're deep into the tendon world, and we know, like, initially we thought it was all inflammation, right? Tendonitis. And then we moved way away from that with Jill Cook and all of that, and it's no inflammation. And then, you know, maybe last 5 years might be some inflammation going on there. So I'm not saying anymore there's zero inflammation, because I think that that's technically inaccurate. But I am kind of drawing attention to, because these folks, it's almost never, they are just, they've only had this for a month. I'm usually seeing them, it's been like a couple of years of shoulder pain, or, you know, this person that I just referenced was, we're 9 months out, right? And the way that I'll talk about it is, like, inflammation is an acute and short-lived process, right? That it's a reaction to something that's occurring. And if we're 9 months out from an event, or you have multi-year history, this is no longer classical inflammation. And that clicks for them. They're like, oh yeah, it's not an ankle sprain, right? It's not that. And so then I get into, hey, there's this other process going on. So that's usually kind of how I'll address it. Hey, like, you know, this has been around for a long time, not really normal inflammation, right? The ice hasn't been working. The NSAIDs haven't been working. This keeps coming back. And then kind of enter into what it actually needs is loading, because we're dealing with X and Y. So that's usually how I'll talk about inflammation, but definitely comes up a lot with shoulders.
Okay, that's a nice entry. That's a nice idea to frame it that way. And I think, yeah, people can relate to that. I mean, almost everyone that talks to me is talking about their inflammation in their tendon, right? So when I asked Ebony Rio when she was on the podcast, when I asked her how she describes it, or how she tells patients what's going on in that, and how she describes tendinopathy and stuff, she just said, and I love that, tendinopathy means that you have to train your tendon. That was her answer on,
she just,
like,
skipped all the steps straight to, like, tendinopathy.
And I
it's not wrong.
So that was a nice one. But yeah, I mean, and another thing that so many ideas coming to my mind that now that I've written all that all these questions down. But so I mean, one thing, especially in the shoulder, that is usually discussed all throughout the last 20 years, where we first started with that impingement thought that we have there's a shortage, or there's just some narrow passage in the joint where the tendons travel through, and if it's too narrow, then the tendon gets like ripped or overused, just because of the anatomical structures here. Is that I know what it's like in Germany, because here everything's shoulder related pain is still an impingement. What's it like in the US? Is it also still the same way we talk about impingement stuff, or is it not that
it's pretty similar. It's pretty similar, I will say, actually. That same person that I was just referencing, the woman I saw on just earlier this week, anytime she had pain overhead, she described it to me as impingement. So So that was clearly like those things had been fused, at least in the terms of like how things had been described to her. My understanding is that we are all impinging anytime we go overhead. That is just how joint action works. And in my experience, if it's an irritable tissue already, and that, 'cause it's basically compression, right? So if we know that tendons don't like compression, at least that's my understanding from some of the current research. And so if I'm taking a tendon that is already maybe irritable, maybe already has a little bit more size to it, and then I put it into that same place, it makes sense to me why I'm going to get some symptoms there. I do think that there is value in having a shoulder blade move more appropriately as you go overhead to allow for maybe a more optimal or shorter motion, which maybe has it, quote unquote, impinge later in the motion because that shoulder blade is moving appropriately. So I'm actually able to get that humerus up there. So I will do some neuromuscular re-education if I see that we have a significant deficit there. So there was another individual I was working with recently. He's a high-level athlete. He's a trainer, actually, and he had a shoulder that was moving quite oddly. And you see this normally, like when somebody's had pain for a long time, it can really impact like how fluidly that shoulder is going to move. And in my mind, it's because it's just such a complex joint. Like as compared to a knee, you know, we got one motion, right? Here I've got so many things that the brain needs to coordinate. And he was getting somewhat of an impingement. We did a little bit of cueing to help that shoulder blade to move a little bit better. And in like a week, all of a sudden he has more overhead. It's not hurting as much. And it was a little bit of just like, oh yeah, the shoulder did need to move a little bit so that it wasn't running into it right away. So I think to sum all that up, everybody's impinging. If you already have pain, it's absolutely going to hurt. And it probably matters a little bit how that shoulder blade's moving, but I do think, generally speaking, it's an overemphasized thing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, just coming from the standpoint of like disproving stuff, so that people are not like too worried. Usually, in these cases, I just tell them. It wasn't painful all your life, and the anatomical structures have been like that probably most of your adulthood, right? So yeah. Why is it not hurting all the time if the impingement is the problem? I mean, as you just said, if the tendon is irritated and maybe some swelling because of the all this, I assume the same stuff that goes on with the Achilles and the patella, where you have proteoglycans and other structures that like pull water into it or fluid into it, and then maybe there's just a little bit more room and we don't have that much in the shoulder, and then it matters more then. But yeah, as you said, it's that's not the main problem, right? So I mean, we have to like calm it down, and then it's not a problem to impinge, quote unquote, overhead.
That's my understanding, and I can't remember it, and you know, maybe someone can correct me, but I'm fairly confident there was a study as well where they were doing those surgeries to kind of remove the bony impingement. I can't remember exactly what the surgery was, but they weren't super effective. So it's like literally if they're taking out the possible impingement by removing where the bones are going to hit and they still getting pain, I think we can kind of disprove that as well. So I'll throw that out there as well sometimes.
Yeah, I guess it's the same for Haglund's where you just cut off the bony part of the bone growth at the heel spur, and then they just assume that this fixes your Achilles problem or your pains, which is not happening most of the time because like the tendon is irritated and overused and not very strong, and so we had that in many cases where patients were getting surgery, the exostosis was cut off and it didn't help by any means. So it's just, I guess, kind of the same.
That is
I mean, it might help in some cases, If you have some calcification or that kind of stuff that maybe like really pokes into the tendon, maybe. But I guess these are like more or less special cases. At least I'd assume. Okay. You talked about the study, the Littlewood study, with the different, yeah. Different testings and different exercises that you use. And if I remember correctly, it was just one exercise, right? For like all
yeah,
the...
Yeah, that was that, this
first for the different...
Called this the self study. Yeah. And yeah, and they would choose a direction, abduction, external rotation, flexion, and did I say internal rotation? Those would be, and it was usually abduction. So it's usually just pushing out like directly. And that's where they would start, and then they would move in into an isotonic. I have found that to be an extremely effective way at looking at intervening on a rotator cuff early. You can often target pain immediately, and then you can get your dosing really, really precise. So some folks may be ready to go into isotonics right away. Other folks, isometrics are really impactful. I've seen them be extremely effective at the shoulder. I'm not entirely sure why that is, right? We don't fully understand those things, but my hypothesis is they're just not getting exposed to an extended load that is producing that strain that we know is important to kind of communicate with the tendon. Just most shoulder motion is either kind of quick, right, or like not localized enough. And so in my experience, that can be really impactful early on. And then as symptoms are dropping off, we're trying to return to normal shoulder function at that point. So push, press, and all of the planes and those things. But initially, I often will like finding that most painful motion, and then prescribing whatever they can tolerate at that time.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very practical standpoint, and I love that. I actually, when I heard that you talking about that on Jake Tura's podcast, I used that for one of my clients that additionally has shoulder pain, and it worked. She started with a 3 or 4 in on the pain scale, in her everyday life when working. And now she's at a 0 to 1. So
there you go.
Well, that's pretty nicely. So awesome. At least what I experience from physiotherapy here, usually it's either just doing internal and external rotation on the cable machine and just doing that, because that magically fixes everything apparently. At least that's what people think. Or it's the other way around, where it's like super, super evidence-based. Everything helps, nothing helps. And people do just rowing, pushing, super general, you know? And yeah. I found neither to work really good. I mean, as I said, I don't have super extended knowledge of all the research, but I just took it very practically when I had shoulder patients. Used isos in positions where they would have no pain, like close to the positions where they had pain, just working on that, and then just gradually working into the positions where they experience pain, and that worked pretty well, and it just skipped all the internal external rotation stuff.
yeah, I see something really similar here, honestly. Man, almost all of quite a few of the shoulder folks that I'm working with and have worked with most recently have been folks who failed other physical therapy, and it was almost always exactly what you're talking about. Actually, it's really interesting that you say that. The woman that I was just referring to, she went to both of the things you just described. So the first group, it was just a ton of what I would call cookie cutter, right? It's just, I'm going to make your shoulder move in every direction that it can. We're not paying at all attention to where you have symptoms. If you have symptoms, this is just what shoulders should do. So we're going to do that. And then the other people, they said, well, let's just de-emphasize shoulder basically. and we'll just do, you know, push and pull and that type of stuff. And she was still having a ton of pain, and nobody actually even talked to her about load management either, even though she was having really significant tendon symptoms. So I like to understand what's causing the pain immediately. So I want to know what positions are problematic, because then if I throw you into ER, IR, we're probably hitting into those in a way that I might not find productive, actually. So I like to really figure that out and then maybe be really targeted with that stuff initially. If somebody's really, if they're not irritable, we can probably do some minimal pushing, pulling, all of that stuff initially. But a lot of times when people are coming in with shoulder, it's pretty flared up and they really don't know what's annoying it. They're like, every time I use my shoulder, and they're not really sure maybe which ways. And so figuring that out, a lot of times you have a really significant symptom reduction in like 2 to 4 weeks, like a big drop off and a big improvement. And then I like to expand into that, the latter group you were talking about, which is like, let's just make them a normal human now. So let's push, let's pull in all of the different directions. But I find a lot of people skip the step that we're talking about, which is like, let's isolate where your issue is, where you're having the symptoms, and then let's build tolerance and capacity specifically to that, because that's your current limiter. So if we improve that limiter, the whole shoulder is going to function better. And in my experience, that's usually what happens. If that's not as painful in those positions anymore, we start to see less guarding, more natural movement. A lot of times they'll tell me like, it doesn't feel stiff anymore, even though we didn't do any stretching at all. It's just now the shoulder is less painful and less guarding as a result of lacking tolerance and capacity, like we talked about.
Yeah. I mean, the guarding, that's one thing that I was just thinking about. I don't think there's a joint in the human body where you have so much loss of mobility or flexibility when you have pain, right? I mean, that's
100% agree with that.
Yeah, they were lacking like 40-50 degrees of shoulder flexion, and they couldn't move into that. I mean, it was super painful anyways, but they couldn't. It wasn't working. Yep. So why is that?
And I've seen it when we dropped that. I had a really interesting recent case where we were able to drop the pain off way faster than usual just using ISOs. I've seen this only a couple of times, but like, we're a multi-year history of basically chronic shoulder pain all the time, gets better in like a week, like goes from like 3 to 0. And we did, like, initially shoulder looked really weird. We dropped that pain, did one neuromuscular exercise, and he all of a sudden picked up 30 more degrees of shoulder flexion and it looked normal. And he and I were both looking at each other like, how did this happen? But it's 100% because of what you're talking about. I think that it's such a complex joint and there's so much that has to go on to make it move appropriately, that if there's a lot of guarding, hesitation, kind of that break being put on, you end up losing a lot of range of motion and it feels very stiff.
Yeah. And I feel like if you go with the shotgun approach and you just throw in rows and pushes and stuff like that, or even the internal and external rotation stuff, then as you said, you usually have just some positions that are quite painful, or people just try to avoid any painful position. So mostly people usually can do rows pretty good when they just the elbows next to the body, right? So no abduction at all.
Yeah,
that works pretty fine for them mostly. But as soon as they just abduct their elbows a little bit, or maybe just go to like 45 degrees or so, then usually that flares up pretty bad. So they stick to the neutral position and just eliminate everything else. And then you have the problem that you can't progress in terms of mobility, because you just don't get in these positions, right? Or you have like exercises where you just have one position and that's at least that's my experience, especially in the shoulder, with one position that is like super, super painful, and like above that or below that, it's totally fine. But in order to like go full range of motion, you have to go through that painful point, and then you underload the structure below and at the top. So in total, you underload the muscles, the tendons and stuff, because it's super painful. And coming from a just the practical standpoint of like seeing this position is super painful, then just don't go into that, because either we have to underload the structure because it's just too painful, or people just go into the pain way too much, and then they just flare up the pain every time. And so we don't have to discuss like structural changes and positive structural changes, but because the pain is just being so big and it's just not calming down. I had that's one thing that I won't forget. I had one woman in the rehab center that I was working in who started crying because her shoulder was so painful, and like the guys before told her that she needs to have pain in order to progress. And that made me think so much, because like recently I had two or three people that said kind of the same, who worked with like a 5 or 6 on the pain scale during their rehab, and that was just, it was just way too much, and their pain just didn't drop because it was like just flaring up all the time. And then these people came from the thought process of pain is necessary in order to achieve progress. And I just try to frame it the other way, which is you can have some kind of pain, which is okay. We can tolerate pain up to a certain degree. Like I usually go to 3 or 4. I mean, research says usually 5, but I would like my patients to have like more like a 3 at best, at maximum. And then that's fine for me, but like it's not necessary, because you know, with tendinopathies, some people don't have pain during a movement. That's especially the case for patella and Achilles, but the aftermath, the 2 or 3 or 4 days of pain in the morning and stuff like that. So you can't tell these people, well, go up to, you need to have a 4 or 5 on the pain scale, because then else they have like 2 weeks of pain, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. We are pretty much exactly on the same page with that, actually. So literature says 5. I actually have this exact conversation with folks, and I'll say like I hate the rehab that you're talking about, where they're just like letting somebody get a 5 to 6 the whole time, and there's no like conversation around like, why does it hurt? Like, is it going to improve after this? It's just like, okay, we're just going to have pain the whole time. That's actually what leads to some of the stuff that I end up seeing, because and especially in like post-surgical rehab, where they're just not concerned at all. All they care about is maybe like the numbers, the range of motion, whatever it is. And they're just, hey, we're going to have pain. They get to the end of it, maybe they hit all the range of motions, and they hit one of the gnarliest tendinopathies, and it has no tolerance to any loading, and it hurts just to hold it up. And so I don't love that. I will say, when I am introducing kind of that early loading that we were talking about, that isometric, that's a time where we'll have that conversation around like, let's talk about this pain, because I do want them to, the way that I'll say is, I want this exercise to communicate with your tendon. We should notice that something happened. If you have no response at all, I don't know. Did we do anything? I'm not sure. So I'll even be looking for, it's just a little warm or something like that. Like just a bit of feedback like that. Or if somebody's coming in and they're already in that like 1 out of 10, then I'm telling them, Grady, basically exactly what you're saying. Like, I'm okay if we bump this maybe to a 3 over the course of, you know, 4 ISO reps, 5 ISO reps. But then if it's the first time we're loading, that's the time I'm going to have that conversation around tolerance and capacity. I'm going to say, we clearly have the capacity to do this, right? You can push into the wall all this time. Nothing's going to happen. We're not going to break. You can hold that. But we don't yet know if you have the tolerance for it. So today we're going to be conservative with our loading. We're going to let it maybe go up 1 or 2 points, but we're really waiting to see how it feels tomorrow. And then that gets that conversation around like, oh, 24-hour load response. That's really what we're looking at to determine if we're overloading. And then they get an understanding of loading is important, but overloading is going to be negative. So yeah, I think some pain is, I think in that Littlewood study, they actually said maybe like the pain had to go back to where it was after the loading, possibly. I don't necessarily say that. I think it can stay elevated for a few hours. I think that's okay if they can tolerate it. But generally, yeah, we don't want them to have a ton of pain with this stuff. And we really want them to feel informed about what and why they're feeling, and also why maybe it's okay or what's not okay. Because otherwise, yeah, it just seems very, very troubling and disconcerting if you're the patient. Like, what's going on here? It doesn't seem like it's getting better. So I think it's really important to be having those conversations.
Yeah, I mean, they are always like, that's what I experience. It's there's such a broad variety of the same symptoms, where you have like some people that have like a super strong reaction to exercise while they are like absolutely pain-free while doing certain activities or an exercise. And then you have other people that are like, it's super painful during the exercise and you have to like really tone down and you don't have to worry at all about the pain reaction because it's like the pain is so dominant during movements that you have to focus on that. And then the pain reaction is not that bad. And then you have the mixture. And then you have some people that have like a super strong warm-up effect. And then that's where tendons are like super, super sneaky, right? Like tendinopathies. Because
100%. That's exactly what I was
looking for. You warm up, it's fine. You can do your workout. It's totally nice. And then the next day you just completely grilled. So
absolutely. There are times where I'm introducing that loading and we're getting into the fourth isometric, the fifth rep, and they're telling me my symptoms are a lot better now. And that's where I will like, okay, you're one of those people. Okay, great. You get the analgesic effect. You're going to get this warm up phenomenon. That's great. Let's see how it feels tomorrow. If it feels good the next day, that's somebody you get to load up isos really significantly, really early on, and you get to progress on quick. But I, at least, especially with shoulder, I don't even talk about the fact that symptoms might go down because I don't want to influence it, and it's more rare, but that is something, yeah, we see as well.
So you see it, but it's like less common than in like patella or Achilles?
In my experience, yeah. I tell them to anticipate a symptom uptick with the ISO. Mm-hmm. Like I'm expecting that. But every now and again, we get somebody and it either has no response or it drops their symptoms. And then I'll tell them they're one of the lucky ones. And then sometimes it stays that way. And then sometimes it was just kind of a fluke. And in the future, it causes symptoms. But that's what can be so fun about this. And also sometimes hard is people don't respond the same. It's so variable. Sometimes that person does it and you get no response. And then the next day, or even like 5 hours later, they're like, I'm a 6 out of 10 right now. I had that with a shoulder and we introduced a really light one for a bicep and he was fine. And then 5 hours later, it was, you know, a 5 or 6 out of 10. And he was like, I don't understand this. I was doing all of these other things and this really light isometric is now causing all of this pain. Yeah. That only persisted for like 2 days and then it started to more normalize. But yeah, very variable responses and tendons.
Yeah, but I mean, maybe that's because at least in this session that you really addressed the tendon, and like before it was just all that's story exactly about tendon, right? So yeah, maybe that. And also what I was thinking about, I had someone who, or I was talking to someone who had like the 24 hours pain response was fine. It was like, I think 3 or 4 was baseline, and then when they did the workouts, it went up, and then within 24 hours they were at this at the same level. That's what they told me, and that was. But it kind of sounded a little bit weird because then suddenly they were like talking about that the next morning was super painful, and so the base level was 3 or 4, but the next morning was like a 6 or 7, but it still dropped within 24 hours. And that was one case where I just said, man, I appreciate that it's not very painful during the exercise, and it's fine within the 24 hours. But if the peak is so high, we should like drop it down, because we should reduce the load, because that's a peak load, that peak pain that I don't want you to have. They were fine with it. that was the fun part. CrossFitters, yeah. But But it's not useful, and that's why where it's like super individual, right? Because you can like put out, and I usually post like once per week about the 24 hours pain monitoring rule, and 4 out of 10 or 3 out of 10 in combination. But still so many people that didn't use it, or maybe that it's in between, and it's like a special case where it's not really fitting.
I think shoulders can be tricky as well, kind of back to something you were saying earlier, like you can be doing a bunch of stuff and it's not really you're not really noticing the tendon too much, right? Or maybe it's you're starting to avoid certain ranges of motion or whatever. And I think about pressing a lot, like especially like bench pressing, that is an area where I think like people end up developing a lot of rotator cuff related shoulder pain, but they're able to make modifications in that motion. And I've seen a lot of people who are able to bench a lot, kind of strong in the bench, they've made some modifications, but then you ask them to do a pure abduction, just, you know, push that shoulder out, and immediately that's super painful. So I think like that's where you can be getting away with a lot of stuff, but you might maybe have this kind of very specific position or movement that's an issue. And if you're not ever exposing yourself to that, you're not really aware of how much tolerance and capacity that's kind of losing. So that's, I don't know, that's just one thing I was thinking.
Yeah, that's very interesting. But I mean, you talked about so many similarities, and I was... in my head, shoulder tendons were, somewhat different compared to patella and Achilles. And I mean, one thing that is very clear is patella and Achilles tendons are energy storage tendons, right? So their main function is to store energy and then give it back and just have that recoil effect. And for most of the shoulder tendons, they are usually positional tendons, right? So they just, I mean, they transfer the force from the muscle to the bone to move the shoulder joint or the femur.
Humerus.
Yeah, the humerus. Thanks. Didn't pop up. Yeah. does that make any kind of difference in terms of like the overall process? I was thinking about like upper body plyometrics or dynamic stuff, which is like usually like I've never seen many people talk about that, and I incorporated that for, I had one I can remember one handball player who was like pain free in like all of the strength motions that they did with him, but he had pain after training, after handball.
Yes.
And then I kind of tried to like give him a little bit of a system of load management, of just progressing, just purely progressing throws, like starting with 30 perfect throws, and then just climb up, and starting with the lighter load, not full intensity, and then work his way up. But is like in terms of like the whole or the overall process, Do you have any, do you put that in like differently compared to patella and Achilles, or do you still do like kind of the same phases?
Yeah, great question. It's going to depend on the individual. So there are some individuals that were just not engaged in really upper body fast stuff, right? They're not really doing throwing, so it doesn't matter to them too much. So for that person, maybe I'm just going to progress like the isotonic exercise eventually to like a bit of a quick tempo, you know, just to maybe normalize like a quick reach for something or grabbing something like that. Or as we're moving back into like normal lifting, we start to do that with maybe a bit of an explosive concentric at some point, we start to normalize those things. But if someone's an overhead or rotational athlete, kind of got to look at it similarly, honestly, because it's often going to be the place where they're most likely to get re-injured, in the same way that like your Achilles person, you know, when they return to run, that's my most likely chance for things to get kind of re-injured. Throwing or any other like fast upper body activity is a place where I will see often there's like a massive gap, honestly, because traditional rehab stops before that, especially for the upper body. And so people maybe will be feeling okay, maybe in tennis or whatever, and then they return, or they're feeling great in the gym, like you said. And then they go to do this thing that is basically, you know, an upper body plyometric, especially throwing, and things get really flared up. So I don't know exactly like how they categorize things, if there is anything that's not positional in the shoulder. But if you think about a throw, there's absolutely something getting stored in the front of the shoulder as we wind back here, right? So that ability to like stretch and then really quickly contract, I think we have to have that capacity and in the shoulder for sure. And then the ability to do some of that that decelerating right through the motion to control the shoulder. I've had folks that is how they got their rotator cuff tendinopathies, is they just were doing nothing throwing at all, and then they join a softball league and two games in their shoulder is done for, just for that. So for those folks, it's pretty similar to lower body. We're going to go through those phases, and then we're going to ultimately, when we're in that place where we can tolerate those high rate activities, we're going to do pretty much exactly what you did and slowly increase those things. Some of it will look more like gym stuff. And then absolutely, as it gets closer to that end range, doing exactly what you talked about, like a progressive increase to the load of the actual sport as well.
That's great. I mean, When I was working with that guy, I just realized how small my exercise pool was in terms of like, let's just call it upper body plyometric stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, nowadays I have like over 100 or 200 jump variations and plyometric stuff, yeah, for the lower body, for the ankle, for the knee, even for hip stuff. And yeah, and there was like, okay, I mean, we can do some bench throws or some med ball throw stuff. And yeah, let me think about that. And then I had to like invent stuff.
100%. Yeah.
Which worked fine. But I was, at first I was like, oh man, that's a really big gap.
Yes, it was for me as well, in an area that I've had to level up quite a bit. So definitely have gone deep into performance rehab world for the upper body, and specifically looking at baseball, and a lot of good work in baseball. And then that's kind of trying to really also increase my library as well, so that we are bridging that gap a little bit better. Because yeah, going right from just an overhead press, just the bench press, just the row, to a throw can be a little bit much. So yeah, having some of those intermediaries, and there's a lot of places to be creative there. So it's a lot of fun, but definitely an area that I wasn't quite as capable, but recently have had to because of how my shoulders I've been working with.
Yeah. I mean, it's even in the Achilles and the patella rehab, I found that there's such a big gap between the rehab gym stuff and the actual stuff that the that people do on the pitch. Like I have mostly soccer athletes, right? So they would just go and do their leg press and maybe their single leg squats and stuff. And then next thing is jogging. And then next thing is just joining the team practice. And this is where it works for some of those, but most the tendon blows up again. And I mean, it's exactly the same for the shoulder, right? So you have all these internal and external rotation, rowing, pressing, and then next thing usually is just going back into your sport. And then this discrepancy between like the forces are usually, I'd assume it's kind of the same that for Achilles and patella, right?
Yeah. I think especially what you're talking about, kind of this, a little bit of the storage release stuff. I think that's what we don't really see in the gym in the upper body. And that's the stuff that I've been able to add to that exercise library so that we're doing some of those things in the gym before we end up actually out on the field.
Yeah. One thing that I was asked quite a lot when it comes to, we had rotator cuff tending up these now, and the contraction type that you used is kind of the same as for patella and Achilles. It's isometric and then transferring to progressing to isotonic and then going faster, right? Can you do the same for the bicep tendinopathy? That was one question where people would like assume that you can do like biceps curls first isometric and then progressing to isotonic, and that's the same for the biceps.
Great question. Yeah. So I'll say first that you can try to do your best to be like, this is a bicep. But I think we know now that even if it's in the front of a shoulder, and even if it hurts if you poke at the bicipital groove, it's still not 100% that you're dealing with a bicep tendon. But usually, if I'm having somebody that is having those symptoms right there, we can reproduce them through one of the special tests. And then also they have pain as we move into extension. And it's kind of wrapping around the front of that shoulder. Usually I'm thinking bicep, but I actually, if I'm dealing with proximal bicep, so more like right in the shoulder long head where we're attaching, I am thinking a little bit less about the elbow function. And I'm thinking more about the shoulder function, because that's really where we have our issue. We're not really dealing with that distal elbow flexion situation. Really, we're dealing with the shoulder. So I'm thinking about it more in terms of moving, loading shoulder flexion. And so initially I'm going to be doing that from like that neutral position where we're getting no compression from it being kind of, behind a little bit. And I will progress that then from an isometric kind of in that neutral position to maybe an isotonic, but with a band and a long lever arm. So holding it with a straight arm and then moving up into shoulder flexion and having that be like under tempo. So versus a bicep curl, which I think isn't really getting as much action at the shoulder. So that's usually how I'm addressing that. And then we're going to work into further and further extension here. So more compression, more wrapping around the head of the humerus. And that is usually like, that's going to be later stage. As this gets better, overhead often gets better as well, because it's getting used to this compressive element. So I'm usually working extension and overhead or flexion around the same time, but I'm usually not bicep curling those. I'm usually using shoulder motion for those.
Yeah, I think that's for people who just think that the biceps is for curling, and that there is another function that the biceps does, right? And I I just had the hamstring tendinopathy in my mind, where it's kind of the same. I mean, you can do leg curls, and it's a little bit different, right? You can do leg curls, lying leg curls, which targets the lower part of the tendon, but usually it's the attachment at the hip where the problem lies, and so usually you have to like focus on that. So
yeah, for proximal, definitely, yeah.
But yeah, that was a nice one because I stopped counting, but if it was a shoulder question. It was like, can you do like heavy slow resistance for the biceps tendinopathy and then just go curls and then just curl it slow? Does that help? And I'm like, that's not really hard.
I haven't tried to do that, but because I'm usually like, okay, let's work. The shoulder's lacking function. So if I'm not addressing that in some way, I think that's usually, but definitely I'll say this. When I first started doing orthopedics and working on this rotator cuff stuff, there was not quite as much literature. And so a lot of what I was doing was just taking lower body and applying it to upper body and mixing it with what some of the upper body was. And it works really well. To me, it's like, why would it not? You know, they're tenosites, you know, they're tendons, what the function isn't that different. They're still attaching the bones. This is all really, really similar. So that's been my approach. I think the only differential is kind of like what you talked about, the shoulder being such a joint that is impacted by if you're having pain in terms of like how it moves. And so we do have to bring in a little bit more of that, I think. But otherwise, I really think they're super similar. When we're talking about rotator cuff related shoulder pain, which I think is often driven by tendon stuff. There are a couple of subcategories for shoulder pain, but when we're talking about that one, I think definitely very similar.
Yeah. And I think what confuses people is that the shoulder is just such a complex joint, and it's not as easy to like get an exercise to target like the specific structure that we want to target, right? I mean, for the Achilles, it's pretty easy,
right?
Yeah. For the patella, it's do a single leg extension. But for the shoulder, it might be abduction, it might be flexion, it might be just some rotation.
Internal.
So that's where I think people get confused and then just try to like do it differently compared to like other stuff in the body, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And that was my experience when I was first practicing and why I felt like I had to find some kind of system, because it was clear that none of the tests were that effective, that we couldn't really say we're definitely targeting this. So to me, it makes so much sense. Like find the movement, find the position, load in that. Or I think they say load the tissue with the issue. I like that term. Just hit it right there. And also I think like I've heard the term salient, or like it's registering for somebody's brain. I think when you do a movement and they feel it right in the area and it is a tolerable amount, I think that really registers that this might be effective. So that I really like doing things that way.
Yeah, that's a nice wrap up here. Is there anything that you want to add or that we didn't discuss? Because so many thoughts popped up in my mind that I threw at you, and you mastered that very nicely. But is there anything
I appreciate it. I don't know if there's anything on the top of my head. We talked about it a little bit, but I would just, if somebody is dealing with shoulder pain and maybe they've had some imaging or maybe that shows some stuff. If your function is, you know, not terrible, if you're able to get that arm overhead and all of that, just kind of normalize that for folks. There's a lot of findings on MRIs for athletes, especially if they've done a lot of overhead activities. And to just say that even if there is the presence of those things, there's still really significant hope that you can get better through conservative treatment. A lot of times, if someone's seeing something really scary on an imaging, we're thinking, I need injections, I need surgery, I need these things.
And I think that's all I would add is, even if you, if they are finding something, if they're telling you that like this is the cause of the pain, it, you might be able to have really significant, if not full improvement through conservative treatment still.
Yeah, that's I like the optimistic wrap up here because, people get too focused on the structure and think that it's that's everything that matters. And completely forget or maybe don't know that you have these all these abnormalities or all these changes in the shoulder, but everywhere in the body, right? And that's totally normal. So that's have it that way. I just remember that I had today I put up this question sticker on Instagram asking people for questions that I should ask you, and there was one guy answering that he just started rehabbing with you, his tennis elbow, I think, a gym guy.
Yeah.
I guess it's German. I guess you know.
Yeah.
Bern, who is, yeah.
German fellow.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. So that's nice. Yeah. So tell people where they can reach out for you and what kind of stuff you can help with.
Yeah, excellent. So you can find me on Instagram at TendonRx, website's TendonRx.com. You can also shoot me an email, TendonRx@gmail.com. I'm active in the DMs. That's a great place to reach out. I help people with tendinopathy get back to doing what they love. So usually somebody who's engaged in a sport or an activity that is currently they're not able to do fully because of some tendon issue. I really work with just about any tendon issue that I think I can help with. So even if it's something maybe someone else doesn't, they haven't been able to find somebody that's able to work on, I'm happy to have that conversation. Because I said it, most tendons operate the same. There are just some unique characteristics to maybe where they are in the body. Some of the things I specialize in, though, are what we talked about today. A lot of shoulder, a lot of rotator cuff, a lot of bicep. I also really enjoy working with glute med tendinopathy, so really common one, pain on the side of your hip. Not a lot of folks doing that one, but really enjoy helping people get overcome that and get back to sport. If anyone's looking for help, happy to have a conversation and see if I can help with some tendon stuff.
Thank you very much, Byron. That was it was a pleasure having you on shoulder tendons. And maybe we do another episode in the future on glute. We talked about that being a topic or might being a topic for today, but I think we had enough on shoulder tendons. So maybe we just reserve that for the future. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.